UMKC's economics department has long been an outlier in the economics world because of kind of a foundational concept generally considered a little bit radical, but people are starting to talk about it outside the walls of academia.
An unconventional economic theory is gaining some traction thanks to the policy teams of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders. It's called Modern Monetary Theory, MMT. Now, stay with me for this one. MMT suggests that governments don't have to
stay with him, indeed. It's complicated and hard to wrap your head around, but it's also pretty interesting, and it's the basis for a lot of high-profile initiatives, the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, and a jobs for all guarantee that people are starting to talk about. All of those ideas are rooted in modern monetary theory, or MMT. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to find out what modern monetary theory is, what UMKC has to do with it, and why we're suddenly hearing so much about it. Matthew Forstatter is a professor of economics at UMKC, and he's going to start us off today. Hi, Matthew.
Good morning.
So if you had to summarize what modern monetary theory is in like three or four sentences, what would you say?
So modern monetary theory, or MMT, at its core is a description of how monetarily sovereign nations can, and to some extent already do, manage the macroeconomy.
When you say monetarily sovereign, you mean print their own currency?
Well, let's hold off on that for a moment.
Sorry, getting ahead of myself.
Let me just say that the main conclusion of modern monetary theory analysis is that there is no financial constraint to federal government spending. There are other constraints, political constraints, real resource constraints, but no financial constraints.
What is what's the difference between a resource constraint and a financial constraint?
Okay. So think about money think about money as a unit of measurement, like inches.
Okay.
Or acres. So land is the real resource, and then acres is the unit of measurement we use to talk about different quantities of land. So, of course, you can run out of land, but you can't run out of acres or inches.
So we could run out of... But could we run out of money? We could run out of money, but not the ability to count money?
So one thing that we should make clear is that modern monetary theory is describing how a certain type of monetary system works under certain institutional arrangements. So, for example... For a very short time in history, in a relatively small part of the world, you had a gold standard everyone's heard of, right? And so that was a type of way of managing your currency.
You would tying fix it to a physical thing.
That's right. So now there's no gold standard anymore in any countries. There are other types of fixed exchange rates, which we can talk about maybe a little bit, but many countries, not all, but many countries, including the United States, Japan, the UK, Canada, they have monetary sovereignty. They are the monopoly issuers of their currency. So in the United States, the federal government is the monopoly issuer of dollars. And those dollars are not convertible into any real resource at a fixed exchange rate the way it would be under a gold standard.
Right. Unlike in Monopoly, there is not a fixed number of dollars in the U.S. economy.
Right. That is correct. There's not a fixed number of
in
dollars.
In Monopoly, there's the number that comes when you buy the Monopoly board. And that's it.
Right. I mean, you could always add to. I never heard that you could, yeah, run out of money. But anything that is technologically possible is financially possible.
Okay. So the big thing that people talk about here and kind of argue about also is the role of a deficit.
Right.
So can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. So first, you know, there's the government budget deficit. That is the difference between total federal government spending and total tax revenues in 1 year, usually. We talk about in 1 year, right? So if the government spends more than its tax revenue in that 12-month period, then we say that the federal government is running a budget deficit for that year. The national debt is the accumulation of all past deficits and surpluses from whenever we started keeping track or the beginning of the country or whatever.
And modern monetary theory sees this how?
So the traditional view is that government deficits will create certain problems. The traditional view was that government deficits could cause inflation, that government budget deficits could cause high interest rates. Now, we have had huge deficits for years with no inflation and interest rates at historically low levels. So even the most ardent deficit hawks, we would say, people, you know, really don't like deficits, no longer put those arguments on the front and center, because empirically, we just have not had any inflation or high interest rates as a result of the deficit. So now the main argument is usually something along the lines of our irresponsibility is going to burden future generations who are going to have to pay the debt that we are running up. And
you put pay in air quotes. Can you tell me why?
Right. So, the whole idea that one would pass a debt to future generations is really rather confused, because a debt is always paid to someone who is alive. It's an intragenerational transfer, not an intergenerational transfer. Nobody in the future is paying money that's going into the past for us to spend. And so
you know what I hear in this is like when politicians talk about balancing the budget,
right?
They talk to the American public as though the budget of the United States government functions the way their household budgets function, like
right.
That it is fiscally irresponsible to spend money you don't have, which in my personal life is true.
right.
But it sounds like you are like just the very fact of the ability of the U.S. government to manage its own currency makes this different, because like unlike the United States, I cannot print more dollars as needed.
Exactly. So we say there's a difference between a currency issuer and a currency user. So households, firms, and state and local governments that don't have a central bank They are currency users, so they have to finance their spending either through taxes or borrowing. But the federal government, when you have a flexible exchange rate and your currency is not backed by any real resource at a fixed exchange rate, then the federal government is a currency issuer, and a currency issuer's ability to spend is never going to be constrained in the way that a currency user's ability. And the one of the funny things is that even this argument that firms and households have to balance their budget actually isn't true. I mean, we all use debt, hopefully responsibly and well managed, but just think of the homes we'd be living in or the cars we'd be driving if we had to pay cash for everything. And firms also use debt in order to invest in future revenues and profits.
Can I say what this sounds like to me, which is in no way intended to like minimize the validity of what you're saying, but really just when I for a very brief time taught little kids, and there was one kid who was acting out, and I had this idea that I could give him some paper and he could like draw on it and just keep himself occupied. And some other kids in the class had a problem with it because they were like, Richard's wasting paper. And I was like, it's not wasting it if you use it. And then Richard had the idea that if we took the paper to the copy machine and copied it, then we wouldn't waste the paper. That sounds a little like what you're saying. Like, you're not, you can just copy the, you know what I mean? Like, it sounds like kind of a little kid's solution to a grown-up problem on some level.
Well, I mean, I'd love if we had the time to tell you about the Buckaroo program that we started in our department. We created our own money. We called it the Buckaroo. You know, UMKC has the kangaroo, and then buck is obviously, you know, a dollar, and buckaroo for cowboys and everything. So we had this money. So the students come into class, and we say, you know, here's how many tests we have and the homeworks and so on. And then also you have to pay a tax of 5 buckaroos this semester. And so they want to know, how do they get them? By performing community service. And so it was incorporating service learning into our courses, but in a way that taught students how modern money systems work. And so we could not collect any buckaroos in taxes until we had spent buckaroos into the economy.
So that seems to get to a crucial piece of modern monetary theory, that spending is good.
Well, that is not unique to modern money theory. Businesses, in order to survive, have to sell stuff. And that means you need spending. In order to have spending, you need incomes. And that's why, really, the focus of modern monetary theory, our main motivation and driving force, is to solve what is the greatest inefficiency in modern capitalist economies, and that is unemployment.
All right. I'm going to bring another voice in on this. Hang on. Nathan Lewis is with us from Forbes magazine. And Nathan, are you satisfied with what you just heard?
Not at all. Modern monetary theory is silly nonsense, but it does have a core of truth in it. And that is where some people get mixed up. We do have a money creation process. Money has to come from somewhere. We're not digging out of the ground anymore. And governments do today benefit from that money creation process, essentially paying the bills. But it's limited by the amount of money the economy needs. And we trust central banks to hopefully use their good judgment and say, okay, this is enough money. It's not too much. It's not too little. So governments do, in fact, pay their bills to some degree through the money creation process today. And it's been this way for a long time. It's been this way for centuries. So there's nothing modern about it. Anyone who claims this stuff is modern is like, just has no knowledge of the history of these things.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. You wrote an article titled The Problem with Modern Monetary Theory is that it's true. What do you mean by that?
Well, exactly that. We actually, governments actually do today get benefit from, you pay their bills to a limited degree from the money creation process. But we can't, that doesn't mean that we can just, you know, print as much money as we like and pay the bills and have a good result. Now, you can actually print as much money as you like and pay the bills. You can do that. And many governments have done that throughout history. But we kind of know what the problem is. You know, back in the 12th century, the Song Dynasty of China tried to pay its soldiers with 87 cartloads of paper bills, and the Song Dynasty collapsed soon afterwards.
Wait, so, can you explain that 87 cart? I don't actually understand what you're saying that the Song Dynasty did.
Well, they were fighting a war, and they had to pay the soldiers, so they just printed up a bunch of paper.
Oh, gotcha.
And brought 87 cartloads of paper bills to the front line
that were printed. Specifically for that purpose?
Yes, and you can imagine what the results were. And so we've been doing
this. I can't. Tell me. What were the results?
Well, it collapsed into hyperinflation, and the economy imploded, and the government lost all legitimacy, and the military collapsed, and they were taken over by a foreign power.
So it sounds like the argument that Matthew Forstatter has said people don't make anymore, that the problem with modern monetary theory is inflation. It sounds like you do actually still have that concern.
Well, one thing we've proven through literally centuries of experience is if you print, we use the printing press analogy, too much money, then there's going to be consequences. We can print a certain amount of money, which we trust, hopefully, central banks to, you know, manage for us. Which is necessary for the functioning of the economy. And we're already doing that. So there's nothing new about that. We've been doing that for centuries. The idea that we can just, you know, pay our debts, pay our bills, you know, finance gigantic new programs with nothing but, you know, funny money. Well, we already know what happens when you do that. So why are we wasting our time talking about it?
Okay, I'm going to jump back in here. Matthew Forstatter from the UMKC Department of Economics, where they talk about modern monetary theory in a very different way than we are hearing from our gold standard proponent writing for Forbes magazine. What is your response to this?
Well, one thing I would like people to try to think about is so-called printing money can have no effect on the economy independently of government spending, lending, or giving of that money. In other words, if you printed $1 trillion and locked it in a closet, everyone would agree it will not cause inflation. It can only impact the economy if that money is spent or lent or given into the economy. So if we are fully accounting for all government spending, lending, and giving of money, and then we also are considering the effects of so-called printing money, that's called double counting in national income accounting or in any type of accounting. And so we can just completely forget printing money forever.
Okay, so we're forgetting that.
Right. Now, you brought up the gold standard, and maybe, I don't know, this could help for someone who, you know, feels the gold standard was something that they, you know, they would like to bring back. So the currency under a job guarantee program, which you mentioned.
Yeah, this is one of the sort of currently on the table politically.
It's part of the proposal, right? So the currency under that program is on what you could think of as a labor standard. So just as under the gold standard, the value of money is fixed in terms of gold, under the job guarantee program, the money wage of labor is relatively fixed. And under a gold standard, central banks stood ready to convert money into gold. Under the job guarantee, the government stands ready to convert money into labor.
Can I just ask a question about that? Does that mean that all labor is equivalent?
No, but I mean, if we think of sort of average, semi-skilled or average semi-skilled labor, then, you know, you don't have to think of every person as exactly the same or.
But I guess my question is, how do you fix currency to labor?
Right. So, you know, we always have millions and millions of people who are involuntarily unemployed in our economy. That is a normal state of things. You know, the official unemployment rate, which doesn't count millions and millions of people, is itself, let's say, you know, let's call it 5%, right? So that means, you know, tens of millions. That's people who are actively seeking work who cannot find work at the going wage rate. So this is not people who dropped out of the labor force, who are not looking or anything like that. These are people who are actively seeking work. So millions and millions of families are without a steady income, and then this impacts the whole economy because, as we were talking about, no job, no income, no spending, no business sales, and so on. So the important thing to understand is that nowhere will you find in any of the writings of people who did the work to develop modern monetary theory, people saying, you know, we should just create unlimited amounts of money and spend, you know, there's no limit to what we can spend on. But when there are unemployed resources in the economy, we can increase spending without causing prices to go up.
Okay, hold that thought. I'm Gina Kaufman. In just a minute, we'll bring a political scientist in on the discussion for some perspective on the traction that modern monetary theory appears to be gaining right now. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about modern monetary theory, an important component of what is called heterodox economics. For a long time, UMKC's had one of the few economics departments in the country where they've used this heterodox model of economics in their teaching and research, and they've cultivated some of the big thinkers out there talking about it, but it's really been considered somewhat fringe in the larger economics world. Well, lately we're hearing more and more about modern monetary theory because prominent politicians seem to be fans, mostly folks on the left, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders. You can call 816-235-2888 to ask a question about modern monetary theory, or MMT. We've got a UMKC professor in the studio and a writer for Forbes magazine on the line. They can address your questions. But for now, I want to turn to a political scientist, Max Skidmore. Hi, Max.
Good morning, Gina.
You are currently working on an article about the relationship between the Green New Deal and the work of Stephanie Kelton, one of the big names once affiliated with UMKC's economics program.
Correct.
Talk to me about that article.
Well, the article will be titled Modern Political Economy and Public Policy. And listening to the discussion this morning, it seems as though there's a large area of agreement that the tone would obscure. The key question here is the productive capacity of the economy. And MMT theorists and gold standard theorists, everyone argues that if you pump more money into the economy than its productive capacity can accommodate, you have inflation. And MMT theorists, and I'm not an economist, but my perception of them is that they're very concerned about inflation and watch it probably more diligently than anybody. And they recognize—
Can you explain that?
Well, they recognize that if you suddenly have an inflationary surge, you need to take measures to deal with that surge.
Is the question not whether you can spend and create the money with which to spend when needed, but more a question of what occasions merit that?
Now, there's something to that. The basic idea that a sovereign government that controls its own currency can generate whatever amount of that currency it chooses.
Like in wartime or emergencies, right, that's kind of standard.
Right. Put it this way. The United States pays its bills in dollars, and it creates dollars. And it receives a huge amount of money, income, resources, in taxes. But its ability to generate dollars isn't affected by that. If it doesn't receive the money, it has as much ability to generate dollars as if it did. It can pay as much as it chooses to pay without affecting its ability to generate more dollars. And
so what does this have to do with the Green New Deal? Can you explain that?
Well, there is literally no direct relationship between government spending at the national level and taxation. You could have a Green New Deal theoretically with no taxation.
Stop blowing my mind. Wait, what are you, what?
It's common wisdom, conventional wisdom, that every dollar the United States government spends has to come from somewhere. You either get it from taxation or you get it from borrowing. And basically, that's not true. They get it from creation. They create the dollars that they spend. Dollars aren't something
mystical.
And
that's already true?
Yes. Dollars are not something mystical that exists out there in the ether. They're a tool that governments create to manage their economy.
So, like, if people need more hammers, someone makes more hammers?
Mm-hmm. If you have enough wood and have enough metal to create the hammers, you can continue to do it so long as you have the resources. But if you exceed the resources, then you can't do it.
So tell me more quickly about what this has to do with the Green New Deal, because I'm still waiting for this.
Well, people are concerned about the Green New Deal because they argue that you have to get the money from somewhere, and we have to find the money to do it, and this is going to cause inflation. Even in a situation when you don't have any inflation to speak of, they're concerned about that. The Green New Deal really is very similar to what, in an environmental sense, to what Franklin Roosevelt proposed in 1944 in his State of the Union message and repeated it again in his final message in 1945. He called it the Second Bill of Rights, an economic bill of rights. And it was guaranteed employment at a decent level, guaranteed housing, and so forth. Now, look at one particular...
Because there was a creation of jobs.
Right. Look at one particular aspect of the current economy, and that is student debt. And I understand that the student debt now exceeds the debt on plastic, on credit cards. And it is a huge drag on the economy because it limits the spending ability of large numbers of people. And we have generated ourselves into a corner, in a sense, in that higher education has become essential, but it's become out of reach for most people to achieve without creating a large amount of debt. We could help the economy. And again, I'm not an economist, but there's no fiscal reason, it seems to me, why you couldn't simply buy up all the student debt. And you could say, well, this would be an unearned benefit to the lenders. Well, so what? That's collateral damage. You can tax that back if you want to do that.
So it does sound to me that what we're talking about is what constitutes an emergency. So, like, the argument here is that from, like, the standpoint of the Green New Deal, our environment is in a state of emergency. So it warrants this kind of approach, just like the Great Depression warranted Roosevelt, you know, warranted.
But he extended it beyond the Depression. He says this is morally and ethically and economically what we should be doing because it will improve the lives of people. If you look at the situation after World War II, the national debt was, I think, something like 125%, far more than it is today. And Austerians said, we need austerity. We need to tighten our belts. Even so sophisticated a thinker as Barack Obama said that when things get tight, people have to tighten their belts. When things get tight for government, government has to tighten its belt. No, it doesn't work like that. How did we, what Austrian policies did we adopt at the end of World War II? Well, we educated all returning GIs who wanted to go to college, and the United States had never done that before. They could go to college and could get their books paid for, their tuition paid for, their living expenses paid
GI Bill.
GI Bill. What about entitlements? They're going to kill us, right? What we did was expand entitlements, expand Social Security and make it nearly universal. Under President Eisenhower, a relatively conservative Republican, we adopted a huge new and expensive benefit.
Can I jump in here, Max? I know I'm opening a giant can of worms asking this question of you because you have written a book on this. But a lot of people would say that expanding Social Security has ultimately become problematic.
Mm-hmm. And they're wrong. It has become problematic, I admit, in a political sense, not in an economic sense. There's no way that we can find it impossible to pay our accumulated benefits in Social Security if we choose to do it. It's a question of political will.
So quick question, though. With modern monetary theory being talked about more by very prominent politicians, mm-hmm. is it your perception that modern monetary theory is becoming more mainstream, or is it your perception that we are seeing politicians who are further from the center becoming more prominent?
Well, the mainstream shifted dramatically to the right when Ronald Reagan became president. So questions of mainstream are relative. And I'd say it is becoming more mainstream. And in a sense, the mainstream may be shifting ever so small amounts to the left again.
Do you think that we'll see modern monetary theory shaping policy to a greater extent going forward?
Well, it depends on the political effects of the country and how political rhetoric is taken by the people. Do they accept nonsense as sense or do they not? And too often they have in the past. This is the quotation has been attributed to Will Rogers, to Mark Twain, to various people. But Will Rogers said something to the effect that it ain't what people don't know that's so dangerous. It's what people know that just ain't so. And that's certainly true with regard to Social Security. But my point about the post-World War II world, under Eisenhower, we had the largest public works program in human history, Interstate Highway Program. We had disability benefits, a very expensive benefit added to Social Security. We expanded Social Security. Under Harry Truman, you had, and FDR, we had the GI Bill. All of these things, and we all remember the Great Depression of 1953, right? No. What the result was prosperity, and we grew our way out of the debt.
You know, Matthew Forstatter, jump back in here. What do you hear in Max's sort of pairing of modern monetary theory with the political arc of the United States history?
Right. So I think there are several issues. One is, like you mentioned, everyone knows that when there's a time of war, then we have the resources that, they have to be dedicated to fighting the challenge or whatever. And so, yes, exactly what you said, that, climate change and many other environmental problems, but also I would say unemployment and poverty. It's time we started thinking of those as national emergencies and using the public purse, which is intended for the good of the people, to eliminate these irrationalities of our economic system.
And now, healthcare and education, too.
Healthcare and education. And so, your other guest and other commentators have often said, these ideas are not new, they've been around a long time, things like that. So they pretty much admit. And so Mr. Lewis, he's Paul Samuelson, Nobel Prize winning American economist. He's on YouTube saying a similar thing. Yes, there's no limit to the government's ability to spend in terms of money creation, but we should pretend as though there is.
Yeah. And actually, Nathan, I want you to jump back in here because you do write almost exactly that in your article. You write, government can in part pay its bills with the printing press, but this works best when the government acts as if it cannot. Why do you say that?
Well, because the money creation process, which is managed by central banks, does produce a financial benefit for governments. And it has for a long time. Go back to the Bank of England, 1694. It was formed to make a loan to the government. But what manages the amount of money in the economy is, for better or for worse, central bankers' perception of what the economy needs to conduct this business, right? You don't want too much, you have problems. You don't want too little because you have problems. So you kind of want just the right amount. Well, that's determined by, you know, broader economic things. Once you link the decision-making process from that to, well, we just want to pay for some program, Green New Deal, whatever. Now you change the process by which the amount of money is determined, right? Well, we just have a deficit, so we're just going to print money, right? Whether that economy demands that, whether it's justified, it's not even part of the decision-making process anymore. I think that's what Paul Samuelson's getting at, exactly what I have to say about the same thing.
So Matthew Forstetter, this is what's being made, what we're hearing is what you might call like a mainstream argument on some level. Maybe not. Maybe it's not fair to label things that way. But what is your response to it?
Right. So I think rather than lying to the public over and over and over again about the debt ceiling, the fiscal cliffs, that the country's going to go bankrupt, that we're not going to be able to, all these things, right? And then the scare tactics that are used, Social Security, we're not going to be able to pay for it, you know, all these kind of things.
So you see these as scare tactics?
Absolutely. And
for
there
what
are
benefit, though?
Some, well, okay, there are those who they prefer, you know, small government. And so they don't want anything that could change that narrative away from we have to downsize government and so on to, you know, the
I think that's the real key here. At base, this is not an economic question. It's a political question. It's an ideological question in preference for small government. Gold standards restrict what governments can do. And the implication there is that it's the size of governments that's important, not any fiscal process.
Well, our time is up, but this has been a fascinating conversation about modern monetary theory with economist Matthew Forstetter, Forbes magazine writer Nathan Lewis, Max Skidmore with us from UMKC's Political Science Department. Thank you all so much, and I'd encourage all of our listeners to research it more. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Thanks so much for having us.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard continues in just a minute with something entirely different. Stay tuned.
My parents weren't afraid to talk about politics.
How would you feel if you were thrown into a conversation with a total stranger that started like this?
They typically vote Republican. I think they're registered Republican. And they were talking about abortion.
Mm-hmm. Conversations between strangers on opposite sides of searing divides are happening in Kansas City and across the country as part of a new StoryCorps project called One Small Step. Stacy Todd of StoryCorps joins us now to talk about that. Hi, Stacy.
Hi there.
Tell me about the project and how it differs from the StoryCorps we all know and love and cry about all the time.
Sure. Well, traditionally, StoryCorps, as you know it, is a conversation between two people who know each other. And out of the election of 2016, our founder, Dave Isay, was inspired to create One Small Step. Basically, we're taking the StoryCorps model and seeing if we can make it work with strangers. So two people who don't know each other sit down for an uninterrupted conversation for 40 minutes, not specifically to talk about policy or issues, but to get to know each other and to learn a little bit about a stranger and how they came to become the person who they are.
But it's not if I understand it right, it's not just any stranger. It's a stranger on the opposite side of some kind of divide, whether that's a political divide or something else that would, on the surface of it, put people in kind of different camps in some way.
That's true. We are looking for people who believe differently. But you'll see, and through the progress of the project in Kansas City, that most people, I mean, I would venture to say all people, can find something that's common between the two of them. So yeah, we're not looking for like sensational pairings between people who like are extreme. We're just looking for regular people who believe differently. So basically you're sitting down for a conversation with somebody you most likely would never meet in your regular day-to-day life. So yeah, we're looking for people who believe differently, but to talk about just personal experiences and to explain their beliefs a bit more.
Can you explain that piece of it, the unlikelihood that these people would meet in their day-to-day lives?
Well, I guess I shouldn't say that they're unlikely to meet, but like you might pass somebody in the street or in the grocery store and you're not going to sit down and have an intimate conversation with them. So you're having a conversation with somebody that, you know, is probably from a different background than you are, grew up maybe in a different part of town, or, you know, just goes about their life doing different things, has different hobbies, different, you know, social circles. So we are looking for people who identify differently politically. So and it does seem like in our modern world, people are a little bit in a vacuum, you know, with feedback loops about their, you know, the people. When you go on Facebook, you're mostly like hearing exactly what you believe. So people need to be able to step out of their comfort zone a little bit for this program. But we're really excited about it. And in general, people are very polite and happy to meet a stranger.
Well, we're going to hear one of the One Small Step stories that aired nationally. And this is one about a Muslim woman who came to the defense of a Trump supporter being attacked at an anti-Trump rally. Anything you want to say about this before we play it?
It touches me. I don't think that there's anything else I need to say. It speaks for itself. I'm excited that you're playing it.
Okay, let's listen.
I noticed you with the hat, and I noticed that you were surrounded by some people, and I noticed that they were being kind of threatening.
I heard a click of a lighter right behind my ear, and there were about three people trying to light my shirt on fire with lighters.
And then somebody snatched your hat off your head. And that's the point where something kind of snapped inside me, because I wear a Muslim hijab, and I've been in situations where people have tried to snatch it off my head.
Wow.
And I rushed towards you and I just started screaming, "Leave him alone. Give me that back."
I don't think we could be any further apart as people. And yet it was just kind of like this common, "That's not okay" moment. You are genuinely the only Muslim person I know. It's not that I've actively avoided. It's just,
yeah,
I've just never been in the position where I can interact for an extended period of time. So I guess my views on the Muslim community have been influenced by a lot of the news articles and things of that nature.
I feel like a lot of times in the media, you don't see the normal Muslim, the one that listens to classic rock like I do. you don't meet that Muslim.
Can you tell me about where you grew up? What was that part of your life like?
So I was born in Baghdad, in Iraq. I moved to the U.S. when I was 10 years old.
Okay.
Being a Muslim girl, I stood out in almost every single way that you can in middle school, the worst time to stand out. What about you? How was it like when you grew up?
I was homeschooled. So it was a vastly different experience socially. I didn't have, I guess, as many friends as most people would. I only went to public school 1 year of my life, and I got in 3 fights, and I lost all of them. I actually lost a lot of friends because of selection, because of my political stance. So I hope that I can be the reason that someone decides to talk to someone, as opposed to just cutting them out of their life or blocking them on Twitter, yeah. You know?
I'd like for this to encourage other people to engage in more conversations with people that you don't agree with.
That's what it's all about. I'm so glad I wasn't the only one who felt like that.
Stacey Todd, jump back in. And, you know, these are the kinds of conversations you're hoping will happen. These two conversationalists actually met in real life. But in general, you're pairing people?
Yes, so that's correct. So this is a little bit of an unusual one small step conversation. For folks in Kansas City who are interested, we're asking people to fill out a brief survey at kcur.org/onesmallstep. And it basically just asks some general background information about you and your political beliefs. And then the team that's working on this project at KCUR will be going through those responses and pairing people appropriately. So we don't need people to be complete polar opposites on the political spectrum of their beliefs, but we're looking for people who are sufficiently different. But yeah, this situation was unique because there was a culminating event that, you know, the Trump rally or protest. I forget which it was.
So my curiosity here is just, do you know if both of those people left the conversation feeling politically the way that they felt going in?
Yeah, well, our idea was never that people would change their minds. It's all about recognizing shared humanity between people. So we're not, the point is not at all to change anybody's mind.
I totally get that. But I think that there's a part of all of us that can't help but be curious about whether these conversations change something or make it people think differently.
I have some information about that. So throughout 2018, that was the pilot year for StoryCorps doing One Small Step, and we worked with researchers out of the University of Arizona to see if there is a change in people's perceptions before and after participating in One Small Step. And we have seen, strikingly, that there is an increased sense of hope after participating, and a desire to engage, to continue the conversation and to continue engaging with people that you might not otherwise. So we worked with researchers who specialize in empathy. And so we were thrilled to see the results from that. So yeah, increased sense of hope and decreased fear is what we're seeing.
Kansas City, as you have mentioned, is one of the cities where you are really actively seeking to record a lot of these conversations. Why were we chosen? Is there something other than the fabulous people at KCUR, of course, is there something about our location that made this a good spot for you?
Yes. Well, so we were starting this project knowing that we were going to choose six different radio stations. And of course, we, StoryCorps and KCUR, have a deep and close connection. But more than that, it is, you know, it's smack in the middle of the country. You know, we needed to make sure we were representing a place in the Midwest. And it politically and historically, Kansas City is a fascinating place. So beyond that, I mean, yeah, and like you said, the staff at KCUR is incredible. So,
well, when you talk about historically, what's significant about Kansas City, when you think about the goals of One Small Step, what are you thinking about?
Well, I'm not a historian by any stretch, but I spent a week in Kansas City a month ago in preparation for this project to launch, and I just think it's an interesting mix of cultures in the country, like unlike a lot of places. I'm sorry, I can't be more specific than that. I'm sort of feeling on the spot because I don't want to, you know, we're talking to people in Kansas City right now, so I don't want to pretend to be an expert on your city, but I think it's a fascinating place.
Well, so what are you hearing in these stories that excites you?
Like I personally, just when people find common ground and recognize shared humanity, that is the most exciting thing, and that is all we're looking for. So that just makes me the happiest.
Well, Stacy Todd of StoryCorps, bringing One Small Step to Kansas City, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And as Stacy mentioned, kcur.org/onesmallstep is where you can go if you want to sign up to participate, to sit down and record a conversation with a stranger who is on the opposite side of some kind of divide from you. Nothing sensational, just a difference in perspective. KCUR.org/onesmallstep. That's a wrap. You can find anything we talked about today at KCUR.org/centralstandard. We spent most of the show talking about modern monetary theory, a scintillating economics conversation that you should definitely listen to if you missed it. KCUR.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow is an Arts Friday. That means it's First Friday in Kansas City, and we will hear about all kinds of projects, including one tied to the annual powwow at KU. A member of the Wichita tribe is building a grass dwelling outside of the Lead Center. That story and more tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.